I'm just going to lay out a little bit about my plan for the week here. So I have three sessions this week here, and today I'm starting with climate change on Wednesday. The title of the topic is How Many People Can Live on the Earth, and it's kind of a way of looking at this carrying capacity of the planet. And on Friday, we switch over to a topic I call the happiness machine, which is really about power structures, and it's a way of trying to integrate everything that's wrong with the world. I'm kind of mentioning this sort of progression here because as a board, we're working on a five-year strategic plan right now, and we're wrestling with all of these different kinds of topics. I mean, we think about the carbon footprint of what it takes for you to get to Holden Village, what it takes for us as a board member to meet to get to Holden Village, the way the village operates, and so, you know, climate change is one of the big topics, and so we're thinking about that as a board. What can we do as a board meaningfully to look at Holden's carbon footprint internally, but also look at Holden's Village role in external, taking what we learned here, using it out in the rest of the world, maybe doing advocacy kind of work, things like that. So we're looking both internally and externally on what we would like to do for a strategic plan over the next 5 years. The power structures one at the end of the week, we think about that a lot as well, just unbalanced power structures where the ones on top are harming the ones on the bottom, and obviously you can find links with that for climate change, but it relates to social justice, it relates to on many different levels, and so we think about that as a topic for the strategic plan and how to integrate that. But we also think about Holden as a place where you can have tough conversations, talk about things that people don't really want to talk about very much. And so that's kind of my contribution for Wednesday, is to spend some time thinking about how many people can live on the earth. It's kind of a taboo subject to think about the concept that maybe we need to limit population. Maybe we need to think about ways that we can rein ourselves in. At UC Davis there, we have this campaign right now, you know, how to feed 9 billion people by the year 2050. And I'm thinking, why do we need to concede the 9 billion? It would be so much easier to deal with the problem if we didn't have 9 billion people. If we had less than 9 billion people, it would be a problem. It would be much more manageable. But we don't talk about it. And so we'll spend some time talking, and, you know, not directly. We're not going to spend the whole time debating the philosophy and the politics and things like that. I really want to just kind of get into the idea of limiting resources on Wednesday. We have a finite number of resources. What is it that really limits how many human beings can live on this planet? So we'll wrestle with that idea. So again, let's take a break around 2:30, so there's an opportunity to get to the snack bar if you want to do that. You do not have to. One of the things that's a little bit frustrating about climate change and climate change science sometimes is that there's a lot of terms that get flipped around, and so I put up a little bit of a cheat sheet here because people like to talk about gigatons and they like to talk about petagrams, and those two things are one and the same. But they also like to talk about it in terms of carbon dioxide versus just the carbon part of the carbon dioxide here. So roughly speaking, 4 gigatons of CO2 is about equal to 1.1 gigatons of, or petagrams or gigatons of carbon. And so on the slides that I show you, sometimes you'll see them in units of gigatons, sometimes you'll see them in units of petagrams. And so I just kind of put that up there for you to look at. And then the other reference thing that I think is really helpful to understand here is that we're burning about 10 petagrams of carbon, not CO2, but carbon per year in fossil fuel. And so that calculates, that means we're generating about 36 gigatons of CO2 per year fossil fuel emissions. And the reason why that number is kind of relevant and scary is because if you look at all the models for what is considered a safe-ish level of carbon that we can burn, we basically have a carbon budget. We can burn about 500 petagrams of carbon and kind of stay below that 1.5 degree mark that scientists and many people think is something we can live with. It's not that it doesn't damage the Earth. It certainly does damage the Earth for us to go up by 1.5 degrees centigrade. But the idea is that you can stay below some of those tipping points and thresholds that will make everything get so much worse. So 500 petagrams is our total budget of carbon that we can burn. We've burned 400 of it. So if you do the math, getting from 400 to 500 at 10 petagrams of carbon per year, that's 10 years. In 10 years, we will have overshot that number. So that's why we keep hearing again and again how urgent it is to act now, act fast, and be aggressive with it. So I'll put that out there. So that's just some reference numbers that you can have. Any questions that you have so far about any of this? So climate change, science, nature, or nurture, of course, when you think about the different reasons that folks, I don't know if you want to call them non-believers, deniers. I took another good point here that I wanted to put. It's just, I'm just going to put this up here. I don't want to dwell on it too much. Another aspect of the conversation is the words that we choose, the language that we use for talking about climate change, thinking versus believing versus feeling. And there's a tendency to use those interchangeably, but they're not interchangeable words. And so a lot of times, this is not about whether you believe in climate change or not. It's not about whether you believe in science or not. Science is not a belief system. Science is a think system. And so it's when you hear people talk, well, I don't believe in climate change. I mean, that's akin to saying I don't believe in gravity. I mean, gravity just is. And you can choose, I guess, to use those kinds of words. Another thing that another word that gets used a lot is feel. I feel that I'm saying that word a lot more because it feels a lot less threatening to say I feel than I think or I believe. And so you get that a lot now in the conversation that we have on many, many tough topics there where I feel because it's less threatening here. But I think sometimes you have to be willing to step out there and say what you think, say what you believe, and not just feel it. Because they're very different words. So I wanted to throw that out there a little bit here too. So in terms of climate change denial, one of the things that people say is, well, the climate has always changed. This is nothing new. It's always changed, so what we're doing right now has nothing to do with humans. It's just natural cycles taking place, and that's what we've got going on. So that's kind of the impetus for the title. And I just want to jump, if I can. So this isn't going to go for me, is it? All right. What's that?
Try going to the...
Well, this is hooked into my computer, so I guess I'll just ditch that. That's not going to go either. All right, then.
Time for the snack bar?
Yeah, so let's try this again. See if it, okay, now it likes it. So I want to just jump right to the end of that topic here on whether it's nature or nurture here. So this slide here shows models for how climate change works, and basically the idea is to try to build models that account for the temperature, and that's in this black line here, and to try to understand, like, can we come up with all the different factors that impact what the temperature is on the planet? So the green bar here is if you ignore all human factors. That's just natural forcings that happen. The blue bar here is if you include human factors, human forcings, things like that. And the gist of it here is that you cannot explain current temperatures on this planet without including human forcings. You cannot do it. There is no way to account for what we're doing based on just natural forcings. And so is it nature or nurture? Well, I mean, of course, there's a little bit of variability in the climate based on nature, because you see these kinds of drops in here. Anybody have any idea what caused this drop in the temperature?
Volcano?
Yeah, Pinatubo. I mean, when Pinatubo goes, when you get a volcano that goes off, it injects all kinds of aerosols high up into the stratosphere, and they basically reflect some of the energy from the sun back into space, and so it takes a few years for those aerosols to get scrubbed out of the stratosphere, and during that time you get global cooling. And of course, people take advantage or think about this idea, like, what if we build a pipe up into the stratosphere and started pumping sulfur emissions up into the stratosphere? We could shield the planet. We could mitigate climate change, that mitigate these temperature effects just by polluting our stratosphere. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where that comes from, is this, you know, what happens with the volcanoes here. So we do get natural cooling, but of course it's not about what happens in a two-year window, it's what happens over a longer trend. And so when you look at the longer trend, of course things are going up, and you know, unless we can figure out how to erupt a volcano, a major volcano, every 2 or 3 years, that won't solve the problem. And there's another bigger problem too with that as well. When these volcanoes erupt and you get this global cooling phenomenon here, it doesn't impact the globe equally. And you end up with severe droughts in Africa, and you end up with severe droughts in Asia because of the way the whole weather system has changed. So we could fix global warming by injecting sulfur aerosols up in the stratosphere and protect large parts of the industrialized world, but it would be at a sacrifice for our large parts of the other world. So, you know, even that is sort of a fool's gold kind of solution when we're thinking about justice. So that's just jumping to that. And I guess what I would like for you to do is to spend, just kind of get into some clusters of 3 to 5 people, whatever it is, and just imagine for me a moment, how would you build one of these models? I mean, it's nice to sit here and look at this pretty picture with the green bar and the blue bar, but do you have any concept at all of what it takes to build a model of how climate change works, about how temperature works, about how temperature responds to forcings from the sun or from the clouds or from greenhouse gases or from the land? How would you do that? How would you build that?
Who is the model for?
This is just an idea about, you know, it's, well, I mean, the model is for trying to explain the temperatures on the planet. So I guess what I'm asking you to do is to put on your science hat for a moment and just think about, you know, what are the factors that you have to include in such a model, and how would you use it? I mean, if you want to think about it on a smaller scale, you could think about it as a house. You've got a house. The furnace stays on the same, the furnace never shuts off, the furnace is always on at the same time. And you want to model the temperature in any of the rooms of the house, or you want to model the temperature of the house. And you know, people are opening windows occasionally, and sometimes, you know, you might have more insulation that you put in the attic, or you might have less insulation in the attic, or more or less in the walls, or you might, you know, there are all these different things that you can do to your house, but the furnace is always the same. What kind of connections would you do? I mean, so let's say that you put more insulation in your attic. What would you expect to happen to the temperature in the house?
Stay
more moderate.
The furnace never shuts off.
It's
going to increase. I mean, fundamentally, this is what we're doing with a model like this, is we're just looking at, you know, greenhouse gas is insulation in the attic. What's going to happen to a room if you shut the door, shut the vent, open the window?
Colder.
It's going to get colder in there, but there's a model for that. I mean, you can think about modeling that you're going to shut the door. What if you only shut the door halfway?
Yeah.
You could probably figure out how to model that. What if you open the window only halfway, but you leave the door all the way open? What's that room going to be like? Probably not quite as cool, because you're still going to have heat coming in from the hallway. But that hallway is going to cool off a little bit, because you're going to have you're going to have cold air coming in from the window. So, I mean, that's all a model is. It's just thinking about all the different things that you do to your house for energy efficiency, everything you do to your house to keep it cooler, make it warmer, make it more comfortable. You know, if you've got one room that you want cooler because you like to sleep where it's cold, but you've got one room that you want it to be hotter because your bones ache. You know, there's all these different things that you can do to your house. That's all a model is. And so a lot of people, they see model, and it's this big, scary, complex thing. And it is complex. Environmental science is pretty complex. But fundamentally, all of us do modeling in our head all the time. We look for patterns, we do pattern recognition, we do so many things in our lives that all we're trying to do is just to sort of look for patterns, predict behavior, things like that. And that's really all that environmental scientists are doing. Did you have a question?
Well, one factor would be carbon dioxide, and that's the thing most people talk about. Mm-hmm. What if there were no carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? What would the temperature be?
More like Mars. I mean, it would be uninhabitable. And so that's one of the things, too, just in the bigger picture here, is that carbon dioxide is neither good nor bad. We need carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, or we would have an unlivable planet. But too much obviously causes problems as well. So so there's a balance to all of this thing. I need to get through a couple of a few things here while I'm going on the big side of things here. The most troubling myths that I think are out there right now is that climate impacts pose a far-off threat. Some distant island that I don't care about doesn't bother me. Sometime far in the future that's not impacting me right now, but it doesn't affect me. And then the other counterpoint to that myth is that the climate solutions are the big threat right now, because they will impact me and cause me pain. They'll cause jobs to, the economy to crash. They will cost jobs. So this is really underlying, I think, a lot of what the climate change deniers might be arguing when they talk, when they worry about whether this is a big conspiracy for scientists to make money, or whether this is just a natural phenomenon, or whether the hockey stick is broken, or all the different other things that they'll use as to try to challenge the basic climate change science. Underlying it is really this: that the solutions are the threat. The solutions are a bigger threat than climate change itself. And so you can understand why that would be very fearful if that were the reality. And so, of course, the way to try to counter this reality is to understand that, well, it's not as bad as this. There are ways to do this that don't have to be full of pain and agony. And then, of course, the second part, as just from a social justice perspective, right now we are living in a very privileged society, and there are sacrifice zones all over the world that support the way that we live. And it's just not fair. We need to have a sense of social justice that goes behind this too. I mean, so fundamentally, the problem with these two things is that it's all about me. And there's no sort of outward focus on other people. There's no outward focus on the future. But that's really when it comes down to what we're fighting against in terms of trying to make progress. Another issue here that I think about a lot is scapegoating the individual. I get to this talk a lot at the end, and people will say, well, what can I do? Where's the hope? And I've been to a lot of other talks, and folks will say, well, you know, as individuals, if we just recycle more, we can make this work, or if we just drive less. And that's actually a very top-down perspective here, that, you know, blame the individual. It's an individual problem. We are the ones who can have the consumption patterns, and so it's up to us as individuals to fix this. I mean, it's a great misdirect if you're in the fossil fuel industry, for corporations to put it all on the individuals. They put this system in place here that kind of limits our choices, or makes it extremely hard for us to make the right kind of choices, and then they put it all on us as individuals to solve this thing. But it's a systemic problem, and it requires systemic solutions here, and we have to get cooperation and top-down solutions that come through the government and come through corporations. This is not a problem that can be solved on an individual level. There has to be some sort of collectivist action here in order to bring people together. Bill McKibben says that it takes like 5 or 10%. Most people are pretty ambiguous and wishy-washy about taking action, but if you can get a group of 5 to 10% of people who are willing to take action and move things forward, they can do it. So it doesn't even take 100% of the individuals to act on climate change. It really only takes 5 or 10%. Coming together and putting their efforts forth to try to bring about some of the kind of systemic change that we need. And then the last thing that kind of just tells you how I think about this in a big picture is that climate change is the symptom. It's not the disease. And climate change is frequently been referred to as kind of a science and technology problem, but it's not. Science and technology are what we use to diagnose it, to try to explain it, but it's a cultural and an economic problem. And so therefore, it requires non-scientists to take the lead and solve it. And there's a role for everybody. There's a role for artists, there's a role for lawyers, there's a role for bankers, there's a role for economists, there's a role for everybody. This is not something where we just get to sit back and say, scientists will fix it. Can't happen, it's just not possible. And because it requires non-scientists to take the lead and solve it, then it also requires non-scientists to learn the science, even if that's a little bit painful, even if you don't want to. It's just sort of incumbent that you have to learn about the science. When I started thinking about this presentation here, I was thinking about scaling way back on the science and going more toward the solutions, and we'll get to the solutions in the second half of the talk. But when I was putting this slide together here, I realized, well, no, I actually still need to talk about the science, because it's important. It's important that we all have a better understanding of how the science works, because the science will help us come up with the solutions. There's no doubt about that. Better technology will help us solve climate change. But the fact of the matter is that we have all the technology we need right here, right now, to solve it. We don't need anything new. If we get new technology, it will make it easier. That is true, but we have everything that we need right now. So it's really not about the scientists anymore. It's about the non-scientists trying to tackle the cultural and economic problems here. I mean, another analogy I think about that too is like, well, you know, if we all just consumed less, then we could, you know, everything could be fine. But if you think about how finicky this economy, can you imagine if half the people in the U.S. just instantly cut their consumption by 30%, what that would do to the economy? It would just trash it out. Because, I mean, we would go into a recession, a massive recession, if we just all stopped consuming by 30%. So it's just much, much more complex than just having individuals reduce their consumption. There has to be some way of integrating the economic policy with that to make sure that you get the right kind of a soft landing. And I get really frustrated because I know that there's a huge economic piece to making this work, to making our society become more sustainable, but there's not a lot of information out there. We're so invested in the free market that there's not a lot of information out there about what an alternative reality could be. I mean, but the free market, capitalism, it requires infinite growth. We don't have an infinite planet, so how is that going to work out in the long term here? At some point, there's going to have to be some kind of a transition, but you don't get that kind of information out there much. And so that's one of the things that I'm a little bit frustrated right now, is that I want to learn more about alternate economic systems that can be helpful to getting us transitioned into a more stable scenario, but it's not out there right now. And so, you know, again, non-scientists need to take the lead and come up with those new economic theories and ideas to try to figure this out. All right, so with those caveats here, I want to kind of start looking at some numbers a little bit here and just think about how this climate system works. And again, it's really analogous to having a house. And so on average across the globe, we've got about 340 watts per square meter of solar energy that hits the planet. About 100 watts per square meter of that is just immediately reflected off into space, and that's called the albedo of the planet. And so you can imagine that there's many different ways that we could change the reflectivity of the planet. One of those ways is that if we had more snow, there would be more reflection. Conversely, if we have less snow, there will be less reflection. So that's one of the problems in the northern climates here, is that we have less snow now, we have less ice, we have less reflectivity. So the amount of solar energy that's being reflected off into space is going down in the poles because we have less reflectivity, less solar energy, or less lower albedo, less snow, less ice. Some of this makes it through and hits the planet. And obviously that's where a lot of warming happens on the planet here. From here, there's different ways that energy is emitted back off the top of the planet here. Latent heating, this is evapotranspiration, so this is heat that goes up into the atmosphere when you evaporate water in any form, whether it's coming from plants, whether it's coming from lakes, rivers, the ocean. So just the mere fact of evaporating water takes heat. I mean, you know how that works. I mean, when evaporation happens, the water that's left behind gets cooler. Well, that coolness that's left behind means that there's heat going up into the air. So that's this latent heating term here. There's a sensible heating term, which is just directly warming the atmosphere. So those are the thermals that, you know, you see the birds riding on thermals, or you know, when the thermals are going up. That's the sensible heating. So that's just warm air that's rising. every warm body emits radiation according to what its temperature is. It's called black body radiation. So the Earth, just as a warm body, then also emits radiation. It comes in at short, high energy wavelengths from the sun. It leaves as a lower energy, long wave radiation from the Earth. And so just coming off the Earth here, we have about 400 watts per square meter of energy that's being emitted off the Earth just as a black body radiator. And of course, this is where we get into things, that the issues with the greenhouse effect here is that of that 398 that goes up, only 240 escapes. The rest is being absorbed by the clouds or reflected back to the Earth. And so that's where, obviously, greenhouse gases come in. When you put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere here, it captures more of this long-wave radiation. You don't get the radiation doesn't escape. So if you can imagine, instead of 240, you've only got 230. Well, that's 10 more watts per square meter that's staying on the Earth, and the temperature goes up. And so you've got all these different knobs on here, and you can imagine that there's many different ways to tweak this. I mean, we talked a little bit, for example, on the reflected, the albedo here. If you change from a forest to row cropping, that changes the reflectivity. If you change it from a forest to an urban area, that changes the reflectivity. If you pollute the atmosphere with sulfur dioxide emissions, that changes the reflectivity as well. So one of the things that, like early on, like in the 70s, 80s, they were having trouble trying to figure their models out because their models were saying that the planet, that certain areas were supposed to be warmer than they actually were. One of the things that they hadn't figured out at that point was just the impact of sulfur emissions from coal-burning power plants, that whole acid rain thing that nobody even thinks about anymore. But back in the days of acid rain, those sulfur aerosols were actually causing cooling that they hadn't accounted for yet. When they added those sulfur emissions into their models, then they were getting everything spot on again. But again, it's just, you know, tweaking all these little knobs and levers in here to changes it. So, you know, any one of these spots on here, if you change something up there, you're going to fundamentally change the energy balance of the planet, and it will lead to global warming or global cooling. So again, it's a budget, and so we work on the budget. So this kind of shows you now getting down to the sort of the nuts and bolts, the most basic chemistry, the most basic physical chemical properties about how this works. So wavelengths, this is the wavelength of the energy coming in. So the short wavelength is highest energy. The long wavelength is the lowest energy. So this is the band of wave energy that comes in from the sun. And every molecule has got certain properties to it that will allow it to absorb energy at certain wavelengths, but not others. So for example, if you look at carbon dioxide here, it will absorb energy that comes in at about 2 microns. And so when the sunlight comes through here, the CO2 is absorbing a little bit of that energy. Everything else passes through. If you look at water vapor here, it's got many different bands there where it can absorb that solar radiation that's coming in. If you look at ozone, well, ozone plays a very critical role here because it really, really likes that energy, the highest energy that's coming from the sun, the UV energy. I mean, this is that ozone layer that protects us from skin cancer and protects us from all kinds of other destruction. This is basically the ozone layer that was being depleted by refrigerants, by CFCs, and so we had to change the way that we did business all around the world to prevent the destruction of this ozone layer. So again, this is a huge benefit to us. Absorbing energy from the sun is neither good nor bad. It just is. In this case here, it's definitely good that we have this sort of scrubber of UV radiation. So you can add up all these different things, and so this is basically like a filter. It filters out the energy that's coming in from the sun. And according to, you know, you sum up the water, the carbon dioxide, the ozone here, and you end up with this filter. So we don't get just a nice even band of radiation coming from the sun. It's all been filtered by the gases. The Earth, when it reflects energy back into space, has much longer wavelength lower energy here, and all these same kind of compounds, the same principle here, where they can absorb energy at certain bands, but they don't absorb energy at other bands. And so here, whereas carbon dioxide is just a little piece of this one, you can see that carbon dioxide is a big piece of the energy that's being emitted off the surface of the Earth, and that's why carbon dioxide is a big player, a big and important player in terms of keeping the planet warm enough for human life, but of course we don't want it to be too warm where it starts to destroy things. And so you get an idea then of methane. You know, methane is another greenhouse gas that we talk about, nitrous oxide, we talk about that. You know, water vapor has its own greenhouse gas potential too, but it's so transient that we don't really talk about it, or we don't, it's not a factor in the same way that carbon dioxide is. This is sort of a more visual perspective of what it looks like. So this is sunlight. This gray line here is the theoretical curve of what a black body radiator would look like at 5,250 degrees centigrade, like the sun is. The yellow band here is what's actually measured at the top of the atmosphere. And the red band is what makes it through to the surface of the Earth. And so you can see here there's a band that's been scrubbed by water vapor. Here's the band that gets scrubbed by CO2. Here's the band that gets scrubbed by ozone. That's just an inherent properties of all these gases, that they have that ability to scrub energy. And it's the same idea here then if you look at the sun versus the Earth, when the Earth. So this is what makes it through the atmosphere. This is what makes it out from the atmosphere, or out into space from the Earth here, that basically almost all the energy here on the outskirts of the Earth here are getting absorbed by gases in the atmosphere. So it's just easily measurable physical properties. It's like putting an R19 bat in your attic. You can predict pretty much what you're going to get if you put an R19 bat in your attic, or you put an R36 bat, you know, R36 insulation in your attic. Whatever it is. I mean, that's fundamentally all it is. It's as easy as doing insulation in your attic. It's easily measured stuff. There's nothing controversial about this. It's very easy to demonstrate that all of these principles here. And so it makes it very easy to model what the forcing is going to look like this and how it's going to impact it if we increase all the concentrations of these. And so that's where we get into the issues of global warming, climate change. This is a curve of CO2 in the atmosphere that was started in the mid to late 50s in Mauna Loa, Hawaii. And that's the Keeling curve, the Keeling plot. And obviously here you can see that the CO2 just starts going up and up and up and up. And the sawtooth pattern in there is obviously a seasonal trend. In the winter time in the northern hemisphere, we drop all the leaves, and so you get a pulse of CO2 that goes up into the atmosphere as everything degrades. In the spring, that CO2 comes back out of the atmosphere as all the green starts to show up, all the trees start to leaf out, the grass starts to grow again. So this is like just basically an annual breath, you know, releasing it in winter, bringing it down in spring, summer, releasing it in winter, bringing it down. And so again, if you just looked at a short little piece there, it wouldn't look like anything is happening. It is not until you start looking at it a broad trend across a decade, two decades, three decades, that you start to understand that there's something fundamentally going on here. And again, like insulation, you can make calculations. You know how much energy that the CO2 is going to absorb when it's at 310. And you can calculate how much energy it's going to absorb when it's at 390. And now that we're up over 400, you can keep making those calculations, and you can use those in your model to predict how, or to explain how, the temperature of the planet is going up. And so again, this is indisputable. CO2 is going up. There's nothing controversial about that. It's easy to measure that. If you look at other greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide in red, and that's on this scale in parts per million, that's the CO2 scale. Nitrous oxide is another one, that one's in parts per billion, that's also on the left-hand scale, and methane on the right. Methane is, depending on how you do the calculations, it can be like 20 to 80 times more potent as a greenhouse gas on a per molecule basis than carbon dioxide. Do you have a question?
Yeah, methane, is that what cows contribute to the climate?
They do, and so do 44% of humans.
Okay, what other things contribute?
Wait, isn't it? What's that?
What other things add to methane?
Methane, so methane come out of landfills,
okay.
anything that's basically degrading, composting organic matter will produce it. So you get it out of wetlands, and so that's one of the costs of doing wetland remediation. There's a lot of really good reasons to do wetland remediation, but you have to also understand that when you do wetland remediation, you're going to increase a pulse of methane that comes out of those environments. Methane, and it's subtle here, and this is where the complexities come in here too. So carbon dioxide, when you put carbon dioxide in the air, it can take 400,000 years before you can get all of it scrubbed back out again. When you put methane in the atmosphere, it's got a lifetime of about 10 years. And so then you start having to think a little bit about it. Nitrous oxide has got a lifetime of about 200 years. And that one, I think, is more potent than methane in terms of emissions. And so even though there's not all that much, I mean, so the difference between parts per million and parts per billion is a factor of 1,000. So we're talking about nitrous oxide that's less, we're talking about carbon dioxide that's more than 1,000 times more concentrated than nitrous oxide, but the nitrous oxide still matters because it has so much more potential for absorbing energy on a per molecule basis.
This graph is kind of misleading though. You've got years 1,000, and then you've got year 2,000. The next one's 1,500. I mean, if it was, like if the first one would have been 1930, it would be a different graph all completely.
In a good way, a bad way?
Well, as scary as you're showing it. You're misleading it.
Well, I don't know if I'm misleading you or not. But I mean, you know, so the start of the industrial age is right here. Mm-hmm. So even if I was to redraw this graph from the industrial age,
but if you stretch that out, it wouldn't be so steep, right?
We're still in the same situation we are.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the steepness matters to some extent here, but I mean, the fact of the matter here is that we're dealing with you know, just much higher levels. But, I mean, so here's a question for you: how do they even get this data back to zero?
Good question.
Is that any fossils?
Fossils, not so much. No.
Tree rings, snow in Antarctica.
Tree rings. You can get temperature out of tree rings and things like that. But the actual gas concentrations.
Is that from coring?
Yeah,
it's from ice cores. You get bubbles that are trapped in the ice cores, and so you can actually go back and you slice your core up back to whatever you know part you want, and you have to carefully thaw it in a place where you've got no atmosphere, but you can measure it in the gas bubbles and to build these kinds of records. And so obviously you don't get the year-to-year variation that you do in a temperature curve where we've got thermometers and things like that, but over time periods here you get a pretty good idea about what it is. I mean, so basically, go ahead.
Just to go back just a smidge, what emits nitrous oxide?
So nitrous oxide is...
dentists.
it's an inefficiency thing. So if the environment was being completely and totally efficient in the way that it uses its resources, there wouldn't be any nitrous oxide. It's a very energy rich substance. But it's more about pulses and legs. It's anoxic environments, and so you're taking nitrate. Let's see, which direction is this going? It's part of the nitrate, the denitrification cycle. And so you're taking nitrate and you're trying to turn it into N2 gas. And so it's the way that we breathe oxygen, there are bacteria that breathe nitrate. They get that same kind of energy out of using the nitrate the way that we use oxygen. And so in that process, the process is called denitrification, and if it goes all the way through to completion, you end up with N2, just like what we have in our atmosphere. But what happens is that there's leaks in the system, and so those, depending on how bad the leaks are, you end up with NOx emissions because it doesn't go all the way from nitrate to N2 gas. It's just an inefficiency of the way it works. And that's just kind of how nature works in general, is that nature is generally not 100% on anything. There's always these little tiny leaks. And so just certain environments are more prone to leakage than others in terms of the NOx emissions that will come out of them. And so wetlands are more prone to these kinds of leaks. Because it's if given a choice, a microbe, a bacteria is going to prefer to use oxygen. I mean, that's the best of all worlds. But if there's oxygen not available, you use up all the oxygen. It takes a little bit of time to spin up before you get the denitrifiers to start using the nitrate. And so in that lag time there where you're trying to transition from using oxygen to nitrate within a system, you end up getting leakages that get out. Once everything gets spun up all the way, then you probably won't have much NOx there. But you can imagine environments where you're just constantly shifting back and forth between nitrate and oxygen, and every time you do those kinds of shifts, you get leaks that are coming up and out.
Okay.
Is that more than you wanted to know, or is that okay?
I think that's okay.
All right. Yeah.
So the layman's term is this happens in the natural world, not in industry. More?
For nitrous oxide?
Yeah.
It happens in the natural world, but of course agricultural practices influence greatly what happens, and so we alter the natural cycle, and so some of the activities that we do will increase the leakage that you have from the system. Yeah. So the fundamental part here, I mean, rate is important. I don't want to say that rate is not important, because that is one aspect of climate change that is so problematic. Is it's not that nature can't adapt to changing climate, it absolutely can. Part of the problem is that it's just happening too fast right now. So rate is an important factor, but all I want to talk to you or convince you of here is just that it's indisputable that we have increased all of these concentrations in the atmosphere. And again, that means that it's a very simple calculation to say, well, if we've got this much more CO2 in the atmosphere, that means it's going to absorb this much more energy. It's a think thing. It's not a believe thing. I don't believe this is true. I know this is true. I think this. It's something that's easy to calculate. So there's nothing that's. I mean, you know. Of course, you can still deny it, but you'll lose the argument because it's going up, and you can calculate what the impact of that will be. So you can start looking then at all the different compounds that are out there that impact. Climate change or radiative forcing, and so CO2 is up at the top, and so based on how much CO2 is increased in the atmosphere here, we know that it's increased by about 1.5 watts per square meter, this radiative forcing factor, that we're holding on to about 1.5 watts per square meter more energy now because of the CO2 in the atmosphere than we were before the industrial age. You can go look at methane. And methane is kind of an interesting one here because depending on where it is, it has some different impacts to it. Same with sulfate. Sulfate can have some different, or whereas ozone. I don't know, maybe ozone didn't make it on. So ozone would be that one. But I'm not quite sure how that one relates. Anyway, the point being here that for each one of these things, you can look at how the concentration in the atmosphere has changed. You can look at the physics of how it absorbs energy here, and you can make calculations based on what the impact is going to be. These are the CFCs that were destroying the ozone layer, but they also happen to be greenhouse gases, and they have a lifetime in the atmosphere of 75 to 100 years. And so even though we have banned CFCs all around the world so that we don't destroy the ozone layer anymore, it still takes them 75 to 100 years before all of that's going to get scrubbed out. So we've stopped it, but it's not healed yet. It'll take a while for that to heal.
When did that stop?
Was that the kind of the 70s, late 70s, I think, something like that. So, you know, we're along the ways. You know, same thing with all of these different things here. You can sort of make a calculation about how that's going to impact that radiative forcing. Black carbon on snow, for example. You put black carbon on snow, it changes the reflectivity, and then you have less energy that's going up into space. Sulfates are a net cooler. I think we've talked about that before because they tend to reflect things into space. Biomass burning. When you do biomass burning, you change the albedo as well. Forest absorbs a lot of energy. Bare dirt. Barren land does not. I mean, you can imagine that a desert is going to have a much higher reflectivity than a forest is. So biomass burning is one way that you can change things. So you can take all of these different things there, all these different forcings, and again, going back to the original graph here, this is all the different things that they've built into their model to try to explain the temperature curve that we have right now. Everything they can think of, you put these all together, and you end up with a forcing, a sort of a cumulative forcing. And so if you look at all of these things together, this is what the total anthropogenic impact is of human beings, about, you know, a little bit more than 2 watts per square meter. That's what we're doing. That's how we've altered that energy budget that I put way back at the beginning. So again, there shouldn't really be anything that's controversial or about this. I mean, there are uncertainties or variabilities around these things too, and so those have been sort of included as well in these kinds of calculations. But it's mostly math and physics. And so, you know, this is just another version then of looking at when you put all these radiative forcings together into a model. Black is the observed temperature trend, and the red is what it would look like when you build a model based on all these radiative forcings. And so from this, you know, you can conclude that we've gotten pretty good at understanding what our climate system is. This is just another way of looking at them, what global temperature looks like from 1880 to now. So they typically they plot these things as a temperature anomaly. So the year 1880 or whatever, they take that temperature and they basically subtract it from the average temperature from every other year. Anomalies are kind of weird things to think about. That's why the scale's got a 0 here and a 1 here. And basically what you can see then is that we've just been, especially here in the last 20, 30 years here, we've just been getting progressively hotter. And so all of the hottest temperatures on, at least in the human record, have been occurring in the last, you know, 10 to 15 years here.
So that blip in 1940 to 46, is that World War II? Is that what?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't know enough about that one to know. I mean, what I'm kind of curious now that you bring that up is thinking about how the atomic testing, the atom bombs, might have impacted climate change. And I guess I haven't done enough reading on that to know how much that might have impacted it.
Yeah, but that didn't occur until, you know, 44, 45, and the jump is in 40, it looks like.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, maybe it's partly what counts for the drop here. Yeah, you're right. So World War II,
a lot more industry, more force, more deforestation, more mining.
Yeah, that's an interesting
more smelters.
Yeah,
a real industrial effort, you know. But
yeah, I mean, you know, again here, that's sort of like the Pinatubo blip down here, and I don't remember if there was another volcano that happened in the
mid-80s.
Well, St. Helens wasn't big enough to affect global climate. It didn't inject the aerosols high enough up into the atmosphere for that. But I mean, so again, you know, you do see that there is natural variability in here, and that's why when you look at slices that are too small here, it's easy to try to say, well, that's just natural. This is just natural climate change, and so you've got to look at a long enough record here to be able to understand that it's not just natural, that there's something long bigger going on. And then this is an important thing here too. This is looking at land ocean temperature percentiles from 2015, kind of on a global perspective here. We talk about global warming as if this is something that impacts every part of the globe equally, but it's not. I mean, you know, we've got record warm all over the globe, and yet here's two places here where they were getting record cold. And again, the analogy goes to the house, where, you know, you can say that if you put more insulation in this house, you your average temperature will go up. But if you shut off the vent and close the door in one room, the temperature in that will go down. So how does energy get distributed around the globe? To get this effect of shutting off the vent. Somebody shut off the vent here. What does that look like? What was the vent that got shut off, or turned down, or partially dampened? What is it that keeps Europe balmy? Why isn't Europe like Siberia? I mean, because it's at the same latitude. So by all rights, it should be Siberian in terms of temperature, but it's not. So what is it that keeps Europe more moderated?
Trade winds?
Water.
Air currents.
Gulf Stream. Yeah. It's the big one. I mean, air currents do bring heat. So you know, you've got all this energy that's coming in at the equator, and then you've got the atmosphere carrying it north and south to the poles. But it's the same thing with water. But water has such a high heat capacity compared to the atmosphere. You can carry so much more heat in water than you can in the atmosphere. So it's the water that really drives this thing here, and you've got the Gulf Stream that's bringing all that hot water and bringing it up north here. Well, what happens if you shut down the Gulf Stream? Europe goes into a little ice age thing. And that's one of the big concerns that in terms of Europe that can happen is that as the temperature warms on this planet, there is a very strong likelihood that we will fundamentally change ocean circulation patterns. And one of the most likely changes in the ocean circulation pattern would be either to significantly reduce the Gulf Stream or shut it off all the way. And if that happens, while the rest of the planet is baking, Europe is going to get colder, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon.
By now.
Yeah, I guess so. But the main point here is that it does not, global warming, it does not impact the whole planet equally. And I think that's another thing that sort of gets thrown out there in terms of climate change denial, too. It's like, well, you know, we've got this Arctic blast coming through right now, ha ha, where's the global warming now? Well, it impacts different areas, you know, in different ways. And so, yes, there are certainly some places that will get hot, but there are some places that will get colder. At least initially. Over time, if you keep putting CO2 in the atmosphere, that would be overwhelmed too, and everything would be hotter. But it's not evenly distributed, and so that's, I think, another kind of a, not a misconception, but just another way that the dialogue gets confused. A way that folks are able to kind of confuse you on what's really going on here is that the idea that this is not happening everywhere in equal proportions. A little bit about your question about rates here, just thinking about the rates of what have been happening here. And if you start, depending on how you start looking at these, from the 1800s to where we are right now, I mean, you can kind of start to see, depending on how you draw your lines, it looks like our rate of warming is accelerating. And of course, that's kind of a daunting thing too, that it's getting warmer faster than folks predicted. This is really just a recap of the first one there that shows you, you know, the observed temperature. This is what the models look like if you don't put in human forcings. This is what the models look like when you do include them. And this is all out of the IPCC. I don't know how many of you went to the session this morning, but there was a reference to the IPCC as a place where you can get a lot of information, the most current information about climate change around the globe. So these are models that they use within the IPCC reports for putting this stuff together. Looking at other changes in soil moisture from 1900 to 2002, this is sort of a proxy for changing precipitation. It's not just about temperature. Precipitation, climate change impacts that as well. So the red is the drier regions over the last 100 years. The blue is the wetter regions over the last 100 years. And so you can see that there's been significant changes just in the amount of moisture that happens in around the globe. I mean, you know, this is considering all the flooding that's been happening in Louisiana right now. I mean, you know, this kind of fits a little bit here. You know, the desertification that's happening in Africa. So, you know, it's not just about the temperature, the water matters as well. This is just many different data sets that all point to the same thing. And we could go through all of them if you wanted to, but, you know, this is the land surface air temperature, all going up. This is the sea surface temperature, all trending up. This is the tropospheric temperature trending up. This is the ocean heat content trending up. I mean, bigger hurricanes with higher temperatures. The marine air temperature going up. We've got sea level going up. Summer Arctic sea ice going down. Glacier mass balance going down. Northern hemisphere snow cover. I mean, that this one here is a little bit ambiguous at this point, but it seems like it's starting to trend down. Specific humidity going up. You make the atmosphere warmer, it's going to hold more water. So that's the specific humidity. So all these different data sets here that we're putting together are all pointing at the same thing here. It's not just one thing, it's many different things that are all pointing toward this phenomenon of putting more energy, more heat into the globe. Yeah.
I would first of all say that I was an English teacher, so I don't know a lot about science. Mm-hmm. And I also that I believe in the global warming, the idea of global warming. But what would these graphs look like if instead of being 200 years, they were 20,000 years?
Interesting.
20,000 years?
So, I'm asking because when I think about people saying it's cyclical, or mm-hmm. it's, I don't think of them in, I think they're looking at much longer period of time. That was always my assumption.
Well, so one of the problems is, of course, we didn't have sensors out there 20,000 years ago, and so then you're relying on ice cores, and you're relying on sediment cores and things like that, and proxies. And so, we do have proxies for temperature that go back, and typically what they show is that we're certainly at the highest temperature that we've been in 20,000 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you speak to a tipping point? Of the planet where, like, there's a lot of scientists that say there is a tipping point at a certain year if this trends are irreversible.
That's certainly a topic of conversation, but I guess my biggest concern is the fact that I think we're going to pass the tipping point without even realizing it. I think it will be more something that we see in retrospect. Mm-hmm. It's not like we're going to say, yep, this year is the tipping point. I think so it's possible that we could already be past it. Because the problem is that there's lag time in all the feedbacks that happen. And so, when you get that initial pulse of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, it initially increases the temperature. But there's a lag time for all the glaciers to melt. And when the glaciers all melt, then that will you will have a lower albedo, and so things will kick up. So until all the glaciers melt, we don't know the true impacts of what we've done right now. That's just as an example. But there are many other types of feedbacks like that as well, where we increase that CO2, and now we have to wait for 10, 20, 30, 50 years, 100 years to see how it all re-equilibrates and comes to a new steady state. So we may have passed tipping points already, but we won't know that until we get 100 years out and can look back and say, yeah, we crossed it back in 2033. But yes, there absolutely has to be tipping points. And I guess the flip side of that is there too, that if we come up with some miracle technology to be able to pull all the CO2 out of the atmosphere instantly, that doesn't mean that we would instantly have everything fixed. There would be a lag time for everything to kind of spin back around and come to a new equilibrium. This is a very complicated Earth system here, and so we can't just flip switches and get instant responses. There was a question over here somewhere too, or?
I just heard that the magnetic north has changed, and somebody said the Earth tilting has changed. Do you know anything about that?
Well, it happens all the time. That's a constant thing. Yeah. The magnetic declination on maps changes all the time, and so you have to be, I have Green Trails maps from the 80s that the whatever is on there right now is no longer relevant.
But I also heard the Earth has changed its tilt a little bit.
Yeah, that happens too. And the Earth is slowing down, and the Earth and the Moon is slowing down going around the Earth, and all of that sort of stuff. I guess it's a question about, how quickly it's happening and whether it matters in the big scheme.
But unrelated to the climate.
Yeah. For the most part, yeah. Again, the time scale doesn't really impact the climate. This is just an idea about what's happening with ice, looking at Antarctica here and the amount of ice loss in Antarctica. There's been some controversy about ice in Antarctica where they're having record ice formation in Antarctica, but the distinction there is that we are losing the land-based ice. The ice that's forming in Antarctica is sea-based ice, and so those are fundamentally different in terms of how it impacts sea level rise, for example. But just in general here, you can see the trend here that we've got. This is the cumulative ice mass loss from 1992 to 2012, and so glaciers, Greenland, Antarctica are all losing ice as we get warmer and warmer. This is another one of those figures that shows the difference in how regional impacts of climate change. And so the one that stands out here, of course, is at the Arctic region here. This is modeled for what the temperatures are going to look like in 2081 to 2100. The temperatures in Arctic, in the Arctic region, are twice as high, are going to get twice as big, grow by twice as much as everywhere else on the planet. And so it's one of the reasons why there's such a rush to get to the Arctic now and try to do research now. I mean, obviously that factors into all the permafrost thawing that's happening there right now, and the lower ice, sea ice extent, and there's positive feedbacks there, because as you get rid of the ice and open up the blue water absorbs a lot more energy than that ice did. And so you get a lot of positive feedbacks that are happening up there. There's also concern that as you thaw the permafrost there, all the carbon, or not all, but a lot of the carbon that's stored there will go back up, and that will amplify everything as well. So there's a lot of concern about what's going on up in the Arctic right now, and one of the reasons why there's a lot of research money that's going into the Arctic. So we're working on that. Model precipitation changes, again, demonstrating that this is not an equal opportunity thing here. We get changes all over the globe. Depending on where you are, you're going to get more or less. Let's see, what else? This is sort of a plot, the figure that kind of talks about that idea that we have a budget of 500. We have proven reserves of fossil fuel of 2,500. So we've got 2,500 petagrams of oil and coal that have been identified. We could burn it all. We could do that. So this model here, they've basically built models to try to understand, you know, depending on how much of this stuff we burn, what would the ultimate impact be here. And so this is basically where this budget comes from here, that if we limit ourselves to 500 petagrams of carbon, there is a 90% chance that we will limit our temperature increase to 1.5 degrees centigrade. That's where that idea, where that concept comes from. If on the other hand, if we double that and we burn 1,000 petagrams, there's a 90% chance here that we will increase the temperature on the globe by 3 degrees centigrade, basically double it. And so this chart here kind of shows some of those trajectories then, kind of in graphical form, about what would happen depending on what it is that we do. So, you know, here's that 500 degree mark. So if we could stick to 500 petagram, if we stick to 500, you know, there's a reasonable chance here that we will be able to keep it down below 1.5 degrees. That's just a couple more slides here, and then I want to jump to, I think, the snack bar. I said I would do that, so we'll take a break here. This is just looking at sea level rise. And the one that I really wanted to show you, let's see, this one here is just, again, even sea level rise is very, very regional. It impacts the western side of the ocean much more than the eastern side. So along the Pacific coast here, we really haven't been affected that much by sea level rise. And so again, it's that concept, that mythology, that while it doesn't really affect us, it affects somebody else somewhere far away. On the other hand, if you're in the Philippines or anywhere in this region here, you're already getting swamped. I mean, these are where all those islands are going under, is because on the western side of the Pacific Ocean there, there's a huge problem. And that has to do with the way the Earth is spinning, Coriolis effects, things like that, where water piles up. And it's kind of an interesting thing. You'd think that if you just are melting glaciers and heating up the water and dumping it all into the ocean, that everything would rise equally, but it doesn't. So you get these kind of interesting phenomena around the globe. This is the depressing one that shows that CO2 in the atmosphere takes 400,000 years to scrub. So we won't talk about that one too much more. Ocean acidification, you know, these are some of the different scenarios here. Depending on what we do, I mean, oceans, this is where the oceans were at pre-industrial age. Here's where we are right now, depending on what path we keep going on. You know, we're basically changing. I mean, you know, this is a massive body of water, and we're fundamentally changing the chemistry of it. I mean, aside from all the climate change stuff, this is a global catastrophe. And if we didn't have climate change to talk about, this would be dominant. This would be dominating our environmental dialogue. This is a global catastrophe that we don't even talk about because it's not as bad as climate change.
Is this acidification? Is that what
it is? Yeah, it's ocean acidification. Yeah. So here's a little bit of the mythology that scientists are in for the money. Total revenue from oil, gas, and coal, about $2.5 trillion. Total government subsidies, direct, so this is direct money given by government to the fossil fuel companies to keep drilling, keep digging, $1 trillion annually. I mean, just think about that. $2.5 trillion of revenue, $1 trillion in subsidies. I mean, I don't know what that looks like for other kinds of industries, but you know, 40%.
Yeah.
I mean, they're getting subsidized to the tune of 40% of what their revenues are. That's crazy. Total government subsidies, indirect, so this is environmental impacts, the, you know, economists who tried to calculate what the impact is of using the atmosphere as a dumping ground for CO2, $5.3 trillion annually. So, you know, that's over $6 trillion of subsidy that the fossil fuel industries are getting. In the U.S. here, the direct subsidies from the U.S. is about $40 billion. We give oil companies about $40 billion a year. And the total U.S. funding for climate change research, where all us scientists are getting rich, $2 billion.
That's so dumb.
It is.
Yeah.
And so I just, okay, so we're going to take a break here, but I wanted to just give you a couple of websites here where you can get at the science, skepticalscience.com. And realclimate.org, and if you preferred a book that just, I think, really captures a big picture perspective on how all this stuff is interlinked with the economy and many other things, I really enjoy the book This Changes Everything by Naomi Klein. That's a really good read. So let's just take a break until, you know, quarter till-ish, maybe a little bit later, and then I want to come back and show you, I guess, I'll say what gives me hope, although I have... thoughts about the word hope that maybe we'll share with you, but maybe not. But we'll talk about the book Drawdown here. And the book Drawdown is crowdsourced 100 top solutions for reducing CO2 emissions, or actually drawing CO2 out of the atmosphere. And so we're going to get into this book when we get back. All right, as you all.
Where's the bar?
The bar? Chalet 2, I shouldn't say that, but it's probably true.
The new, it was back quite a ways.
Yeah, some of these figures, I mean, obviously there's so much detail.
Oh, yeah. It was close here.
Contrail-induced cirrus?
No,
I mean, you know, that's a conspiracy theory right there, isn't it?
Maybe.
I never really got that. What is the conspiracy about contrails? That somehow it was mind control or?
Well, I thought I saw airplanes on it. Maybe it was back up. Maybe just one or two. Let's see.
Aircraft.
So the new thing about flight guilt. Mm-hmm. This is just brand new, I'm hearing on the news, you know. And they're talking about generalization. One flight equaling about 9 months, perhaps, of driving.
Mm-hmm.
Where's that piece in the big picture? Is it a small thing? Is it something that...
Well, I mean, obviously that shows up in the CO2 side here too. But
yes.
I mean, so this is just breaking it down in terms of greenhouse gases and things like that. But it doesn't break down where all the CO2 comes from.
Yeah. Source. It isn't a source. My eye just caught aircraft, and I thought, oh, maybe it isn't such a big deal. But you're right. That is just one piece of it. It's up there in the CO2.
I mean, my understanding is that, you know, when you look at the whole transportation sector, aircraft is not the big dog by any stretch. I think it's still
industry.
I think it's still mostly just people driving in cars and shipping stuff around the globe on big barges. I think that's still much bigger piece than the aircraft stuff, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't have some airplane guilt. And
if the chart would be up.
Yeah.
I mean, air travel is on the rise.
Yeah.
I mean, more and more people. Anyway, okay. What's plant?
I will grab a chair, and that's. I'll at least let myself sit down for a few moments.
Recently, somebody said, some guy said, he had the idea one of the solutions could be plant X billion trees.
Mm-hmm.
And you made
the 1 trillion trees idea?
Yeah. And then you mentioned that trees actually reflect less than bare earth, and then I thought, wait, what?
Well, so yeah, I mean, obviously there's a complexity there too. I mean, you know, so you have to look at both pieces of it in order to look at the true effect. I mean, if you're only going to focus on the CO2, yes, you can just plant the trees and do that calculation and pull the CO2 out of the atmosphere. But you're right, there's
maybe
other...
Maybe it's where you plant them. Maybe you have to plant them in places where there's already... Who knows? Okay.
I mean, that's the thing about environmental systems is they're so interlinked. And so like in California where we are, there's a big delta. I mean, that's sort of the dominant environmental system in California because 25 million people get their water out of there, and there's a lot of other things that are going on in there. And the ecology is collapsing. The native fish are dying off, and so one of the ideas is to do wetland remediation in there. But you do wetland remediation and you end up producing more greenhouse gases, so it's non-trivial. You end up producing more mosquitoes, so vector control hates you for that. You end up producing more methyl mercury because wetlands are great incubators for converting elemental mercury into methyl mercury, and so you've got all that legacy mercury from the mines down that keeps washing down into the delta, and so you put in more methane. So it's a balancing act. You have to decide whether you're getting a net positive or net benefit from, because it's you know, some things are bad about putting in wetlands. I mean, in general, I think you're still better off to put them in, but it's not free.
How about 350.org? 350 parts per million carbon is what's...
We're way beyond that.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
So they want to come back to that. Is that what they want to do?
I don't know if they have that philosophy. I think probably they would say that the ship has sailed. But I mean, that was their hope, is that we could keep it to 350.
What are we at now?
We're over 400.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did you see the video? I just ran across the VHS tape in my extensive childhood collect from my kids.
And you have a player.
I'm getting rid of crap.
and
I pulled those drawers out, and that popped out of my eye. I recorded it. It was a animated climate change video from about 1996, six or seven, a family and what life's going to look like. It's going to be interesting. I haven't seen much stuff like that. It's like we need more education out there in the, mm-hmm. you know, everybody's consuming, theoretically I'm not, but is consuming all this visual content. Well, how do we get some education yeah. out there in the visual content that's engaging, and we need people like, you know, young people mm-hmm. putting that on so that we can get the word out.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about the right approach, because you don't want to numb everybody to it. At some level here, the science doesn't matter and you just have to act. I don't know. I'm just trying to find that right approach, I think, right now. I mean, it's really, really tough, too, because, we just went through an election cycle where millennials didn't vote, and if they don't vote, what are they going to do in terms of climate change things? And so, you know, trying to figure out the right way. I mean, because there's a numbing there. They've been hearing about it from the as long as they can remember. I mean, that's the first sort of generation that's had that sort of constant drumbeat.
It's anxiety producing.
And so there is, I think, that sort of idea about just sort of you can't take it anymore, so you bury your head a little bit. So what the right messaging is, I don't know.
And I can see how solutions are so incredibly complicated that you don't just want to start stuff up and find out later, oops. You know, so there's a real such a process.
Yeah, I think sometimes that might be overblown. I think you're not going to be perfect.
Well, I'm talking about big scales.
Right, but the things you do are not going to be perfect, and I think you just at some point you have to dive in, and if it doesn't work, then you stop. I mean, I think mm-hmm. we can't let the fear of having it not go perfect paralyze us.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to be making any of the solutions, but when I look at this stuff, my brain goes poof. So.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, we'll talk about this obviously more too, but I think part of it too is that folks are wanting kind of the one silver magic bullet. And I mean, as I alluded to, this has got 100 solutions in it, and we need to be thinking about all 100 of them and more, and that we need to be able to piece this together here. This is not a one size fits all thing. So.
And marketing, we need marketing.
Oh, yeah. People are coming back. That's good.
Are you worried?
Just the crowd thin a bit after this part?
I don't know. I'm just curious to know how long it takes to go and get to the snack bar and back. I mean, so one person made it.
Can I find these on the net somewhere?
The slides?
Yeah.
I mean, these are all from like the IPCC reports, and so you can find them individually if you're looking for just like this slide presentation that I did right here. I mean, I could talk to Jonah.
Conglomeration. Sources.
Yeah. So I pulled things together over time, but I could talk to Jonah and just see what the potential is for putting off somewhere.
I'm
supposed to do one of those too.
So why not include the visual?
Yeah. We're talking about the Gulf Stream in Europe. Is the Gulf Stream unique in that sense, in terms of climate change, in terms of effect,
being
in terms
shut
of
off?
Ocean currents?
Well, I mean, there's the Kuroshio Current over in the Western Pacific that carries heat past Japan and on toward Alaska. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. I mean, it seemed to have a large impact on that particular graph.
So, it's all part of the downwelling. So, in the wintertime, when you get sea ice formation, the ice rejects salt. I mean, you've probably done that experiment before, where you take salt water and you freeze it, and you get fresh water ice, and the water that's left behind gets saltier. That salt makes it more dense, and it's also as cold as it's going to get. So it's cold, dense water, so it sinks, and so that's like a pump, and that water sinks to the bottom. Well, then some water's got to replace it. Well, where does that water come from? It comes from the equator, and so that's basically how that Gulf Stream gets generated, is by that cold, salty water in the wintertime that sinks and starts to draw everything behind it. But if you warm the Arctic Ocean, then it's no longer cold salty water, it's warm salty water, and it doesn't sink anymore. So you basically shut off ocean circulation. And if it doesn't sink, then there's no reason for the Gulf Stream to replace the water with it. So that's basically how, that's in simple terms, that's how it works. Is you heat up the water so you no longer get that sinking, and you basically shut off global circulation.
One of the things, the whole talk just makes you think how small the Earth is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're so small we think the Earth is so gigantic. But when you look at the systems, they're all so interconnected.
Yeah.
It seems like...
I've been getting a little bit more irritated as I get older by the phrase, it's not rocket science. Because I'm thinking rocket science is easy.
Yeah, compared to this.
It's just simple equations in physics. It's easy. Environmental science is where it's at if you want something that's extremely complex in terms of the math and the science.
It's gnarly.
Yes. So we need to change the phrase. Yeah.
I lived in northwestern Minnesota for 40 years, so the climate change deniers,
mm-hmm.
that were friends of mine, we'd get an 8-inch blizzard with 30-mile-an-hour winds, and 2 days later, when it cleared off, it dropped to 30 below,
uh-huh.
and they'd go, oh, yeah, so much for climate change. The Earth's really warming, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the only response, because I'm not a scientist, was, well, you're talking about weather.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about climate.
Right.
Is there a better... Or a different way to approach it?
I mean, that's fundamentally it. Yeah, the difference between weather and climate. I mean, climate is average weather over a long time period, and so I mean, let's see if I can figure out, think about the right average. I mean, it might be a little bit like, you know, just thinking about how often you get sick over the course of a year. I mean, if you get like one cold a year, you know, depending on whether you decide whether you're getting sick or not, you know, if you think about the time period when you're not getting a cold, well, you would say, well, I'm not getting any sick any more frequently than I do other time. But if you look in the middle of when you're getting cold, you say, well, I'm sick all the time. You might end up, you know, eventually you might start getting two colds a year. And the difference between two colds a year and one cold a year, I mean, that would be a significant change. But depending on where you check in on that thing there, you know, one is like weather and one is like climate, so you're looking for those longer term trends. Yeah.
Neil deGrasse Tyson described it as walking a dog along a beach, and so you're proceeding in a certain way, but the dog is going like this, and so the dog is going with you, so that would be weather, and your path would be climate.
That's a good one, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't there some explanation of the cold snap in the U.S.? Earlier this year about something to do with climate change, maybe more likely you get those Arctic currents that come further south.
Well, right, so you put more energy into a system and you make it more chaotic, and when you make it more chaotic, it makes it easier for the air masses to break out of their normal bounds, or, you know, that and escape to the south and overrun things. I mean, the flip side of that is that Alaska was having record warmth. I mean, so you take all that cold out of the Arctic and you send it down to the south, well, then something else has to give. And so Alaska melted out a lot sooner than it had record warmth in March. I mean, it was kind of crazy. So, I mean, there's a flip side to it. On average, everything is warming, but in that short term thing there, you have record cold, record heat happening simultaneously to kind of balance it out. All right, so since I tortured you with an over an hour of gloom, let's see if we can at least get a half hour of some hope. So this is kind of an interesting thing. So 2 years ago when I was here, Alan Story was here, and I got to the end of my, I think it was actually at the faculty forum, because we had another one of those weeks where we had a lot of environmental talks, and so somebody said, where do you find hope? And Alan Story said, you Americans are addicted to hope. Sometimes there is no hope until there's two. Basically, I mean, the idea that, you know, the hope of in Christ, obviously, was that he was going to be this king, and he was going to be, you know, save the world through military might and be the king of the world, I guess, you know, if you want to take that but instead he died. And that's where the hope came from. And so that was sort of his point, is that sometimes you need to bottom out before you get to hope. And of course, obviously in this case, we would like not to bottom out. We would like to be able to come up with a soft landing here and be able to fix this problem without having the tomb. But I think, you know, it forced me to think a lot about just the concept of hope in general. And hope, I think the danger of hope is that it can be passive. And hope can mean, I hope somebody else fixes this so that I do not have to. And so I'm not entirely convinced that hope is a very useful emotion when it comes to solving problems. For me, I'm much more inclined to having something that instigates action. And so, you know, again, Alan's story would say that it's anger that moves things forward. It's not hope that moves things forward. And you know, it's and so he showed this picture of this little girl. You know, there was a protest somewhere, and you know, so there's a military person, or you know, dressed in full riot gear, and this little girl standing face to face, just staring up at this military guy, and you know, it's such a dramatic picture there, because it shows you where the action has to come from, and that the resistance that you have to have. And it's you can't just sit back and hope that somebody else does something. It has to be more useful than that. And so I am, and I guess I'm also of the belief of, you know, God helps those who help themselves. You know, I don't, you know, my wife and I, Carol's back, we've gone through lots and lots of issues with our children. We have three children who were adopted from Russia, and that brings a lot of issues with it. And so we have some people who come and say, we're praying for you, and it's like, screw that. Come and give us a hand. You know, your prayers don't do anything. Come and help us. That's what you need. And so I'm just sort of thinking about that concept of hope within that context here, that it's not hope, it's action that we need. And so a lot of these times you get to the talk, and that's where somebody say, well, you know, we just all just consume less, or if we recycle more, or we drive less, and things like that, which are, you know, which also comes to that idea about this putting it on the individual, that the individual needs to act. So I've been trying to come up with, you know, figure out where do I get the hope? Where is the promise of being able to do something here? And so that's where coming across this book here has been really helpful for me. Drawdown. It's called Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. And the author is joking about that title. You know, he just sort of put that down as a lark until he realized that there is no other plan, and so he left it. It sounds. And so the idea here is that it's a crowdsourced book, and basically recruiting scientists from around the globe to just brainstorm and think, what are the ways that we can do to reduce CO2 emissions? What are the ways that we can, I mean, screw reducing CO2 emissions, what are the ways that we can actually draw CO2 out of the atmosphere and try to reverse this? I mean, why stop at just getting to carbon neutral right now? Why not try to go and fix this and take things backward? But in order to do that, there's no one silver bullet that's going to make it happen. You need a smorgasbord. You need to go a la carte. You need to figure out all kinds of different solutions, and everything has to be on the table. And so basically that's what they did, is they brainstormed and they came up with their top 100 ideas and just individually researched each one, tried to figure out what is the potential. And so they did all their projections for the year 2050. So they tried to map these out, and they took kind of like the most plausible scenario, the business as usual scenario, and a more optimistic scenario, and tried to map this out. And so the numbers that I'm going to show you here are all from sort of their plausible. This is what they think is realistic to do if we're not trying to, you know, outdo ourselves. But of course, we could do better. We could also do worse if we do nothing on it. But so this book, I'm going to leave this one in the library, and this is a donation to Holden. So if you're interested in coming by and having it, and somebody else doesn't have it, just, I mean, I would, you know, I think that you would enjoy looking at it. It's like a coffee table book. Each one of the solutions in here is about 2 pages. And so it just kind of gives you an overview, and so you can just come and pick it up, read 2 pages at a time, flip through it. It has it built in, put together in, categorized. There's a section on energy, a section on food, a section on women and girls, buildings and cities, land use, transport, materials, and then there's another section called coming attractions here where they have a bunch of other ideas there that they're trying to evaluate to see whether they crack the top 100, I guess, and bump some other things down. But I think, you know, the concept is great. This is not about hope, this is about action. This is about trying to think of, and it's not about one solution, it's about trying to piece together many different things and trying to make it happen. So I'll leave that in the library. And flip to my next thing here, if I can find it. And I also wanted to just put this up here too, just in case anybody has heard or not heard of this Citizens Climate Lobby. We talked about, in an earlier session today, there was a question about policy and what's being done on a policy level to try to impact climate change. So this is the Citizen Climate Lobby here. Have been working for many, many years to try to get a Carbon Tax and Dividend Act passed. And so the basic concept here is to put a surcharge on all fossil fuel production. And at the end of the year, all that money is given back as a dividend to the people, minus whatever administrative costs. So it's not going into any more other governmental programs. It's just being taxed so that you pay more of a true cost of CO2 or of fossil fuel production, and then basically comes back. And so there's a social justice piece to this as well, because it effectively acts as a transfer of money from the wealthier people who are going to tend to use more cost of fossil fuel toward the folks who are not. And so part of the deal with this here is that if you want to sign on to it as a legislator, you have to bring somebody from the other side. So it's not just sponsored by all Democrats or all Republicans there. If you want to sign on to, as a Democrat, you need to bring a Republican on board with you. And so that's part of what they do. And the idea behind this act, so it has been passed or introduced. It's been introduced in the House, and the idea is to try to reduce carbon emissions or the fossil fuel emissions in the U.S. by 40% by, I think, 2030. I think that's the way that it's geared right now. Yeah.
Why have a tax when there's so much subsidies of carbon going on? Why not just work to get rid of the subsidies?
Well, you know, I mean,
the same effect, wouldn't it?
Potentially. I guess multiple approaches is the answer, and I'm not a policy person, so I can't answer all of the subtleties and things like that. I think, you know, this is not ideal, but I think that it falls in the category of much better than nothing. I think what it does do is it tries to pay. I mean, so, you know, I showed that fossil fuels, basically there's a $6.3 trillion subsidy on it. So if we were paying the true and full cost of fossil fuels, we would be paying on the order of $15 to $20 a gallon for gas. And you can imagine that if we were paying $15 to $20 a gallon for gas, our driving would slide accordingly, and it would be much more in line. We would have a much friendlier environment to work in terms of solving this problem. And so this is kind of that, coming at that same concept the same way, trying to make us pay the full and true cost for fossil fuels. I don't think it goes far enough, but if you tried to do that, if you tried to pass a bill to raise the gasoline to $15 to $20 a gallon, I mean, you know, that wouldn't work so well. So this is a chipping away kind of approach to get to that. But I think ultimately, if we want the free market to work with this, we need to have something in this where we're paying the true and full cost and not this heavily subsidized cost.
Yeah. And I think this is that this is much more broad-based. This is not just charges on petroleum companies. It's
all fossil fuel production.
All fossil fuel production only.
I believe that's how it works, yeah. That is
not,
it's geared toward
not
fossil fuels.
Other industries with a high carbon.
That's how it was described to me, is that it's fossil fuel based. That's really working at trying to get at that fossil fuel base. So that's one thing that I wanted to put that's not dry down here. I have a student who has been working with me, an undergrad student, who's been trying to take these two-page things here and put them together into like 7 to 9 slide presentations on that. And so it's sort of, we're trying to build up this library of presentations where I can expand a little bit on what's on here in the book here too. And so you know, give credit to Hannah for working on some of these things here. This book, I mean, you can buy the book. It's like $15 on Amazon, but everything that's in the book is also at drawdown.org. So if you don't want to buy anything at all, you can just go to the website and you can browse through all the different scenarios that are in there. Context, I think I already did the context part. So this is a look at the top 10 solutions that they proposed in here. And again, all of these are projected out to 2050. And as best they're able to, they've tried to put like the total atmospheric CO2 reduction. And that's why I sort of have this context, CO2 versus petagrams of carbon versus how much we put in a year. So we're putting out about 36 gigatons of CO2 per year. So you can imagine that if we were able to implement this solution here, we would basically be offsetting about 2.5 years worth of emissions. And so that's the way you start piecing this together. So they tried to put together the total amount of CO2 reduction that you would get. They tried to estimate the total net cost if they can, but a lot of times these things are so complicated that they really aren't able to put a number on it. And then the same thing, the net savings, they try to put it. So you can see there's a lot of NAs here where they're not able to come up with dollar amounts on this thing, and I think this is all part of the ongoing project to try to put this together. But of the total 100 solutions here, they were estimating that we could reduce atmospheric CO2 by 1,000 gigatons of carbon. And so what is that in terms of 36? What does 36 go into? So 1,000 gigatons of carbon, that 40, would be about...
30.
About 300 petagrams of carbon. And so if you're looking at that in relative to that total budget that we have of 500 petagrams of carbon, I mean, that would potentially get... cut us back in half. And so, I mean, that's just to give you an idea about the scale of what we can do if we start implementing these solutions here. I mean, you know, 100 or 300 petagrams of carbon kept from the atmosphere or pulled out of the atmosphere is pretty significant relative to an overall budget of 500. So if you want to know where hope comes from, it's by putting together these kinds of action things. And so part of the idea then is to try and figure out, where can I plug in? Well, for me personally, I don't think I can do a whole lot on the wind turbine idea here. And I mean, the word wind turbine is pretty self-explanatory here. I mean, if you drive up 89 for, or what is it, 97 through the middle of Oregon, as we do whenever we come to Holden there, you know, you just kind of get toward the Columbia Gorge, and it's like the turbines just explode. It's like somebody barfed them up on the landscape. They're all over the place. And every time we come by, there's like 1,000 more, it seems like. And so, you know, this is an idea about looking for all the different ways that you can protect to try to scale that. Where are all the places that you can put wind turbines? And if you put them all there, I mean, you know, it would cost, I guess, $1.2 trillion. But over the long haul, you would save $7.4 trillion. And I think that's another key piece to this here, is that these are not all painful solutions. These are not ones where we spend a lot of money and we don't get anything back except the virtue of knowing that we did something. I mean, a lot of these solutions here actually generate money, and in the long run, if we're thinking 30 years out instead of 2 years out to the next election, they can actually be a net benefit and look pretty good. Reduced food waste. Well, you know, I have more of a stake in that one. Plant-rich diet, I have more of a stake in that one. That's something that I can get at. Tropical forests and land use things there, that might be a little bit more difficult. So just let me try to go through a little bit quickly. So the idea behind the refrigerants, refrigerant management, they're very powerful greenhouse gases. They have 1,000, depending on the chemical compound, they're like 1,000 to 9,000 times more potent greenhouse gases than CO2. And so the problem is that at the end of the life cycle of refrigerators, most of that refrigerant just leaks and it goes up into the atmosphere. And so this is simply the act of collecting that refrigerant at the end of the life cycle. How simple is that? I mean, obviously it costs money, so there's you know, there would be a certain amount of cost that would go into it. I guess this is minus 900 billion in savings. I'm not sure why they called this a minus savings instead of a net cost. Mm-hmm. I was trying to wrap my head around some of those numbers here. So it costs money to do that. But you know, but it's the single most important thing that we could do based on their list in terms of the impact on greenhouse or global warming. Just capturing them and either disposing them of them or recycling them or repurposing them, doing something like that. Yeah.
And who does that fall on? Who should be doing this?
Well, I guess that's where the policy comes in and the personal philosophies about, you know, I mean, ideally you would say that the industries ought to be responsible for the end, you know, industries should be responsible for the waste. I mean, if they were responsible for, you know, instead of passing it off to the consumer, I think they would be much more diligent about how they handle their packaging, how they would handle all of their aspects. And but, you know, they're kind of using us as the commons for disposing of their waste.
Does anybody do it? Does anybody collect refrigerants?
I think they must, but I don't know the details about how expensive it is, but obviously it's not expensive enough, yeah.
In Seattle, Seattle Public Utilities for many years had a get rid of your old refrigerator, we'll pick it up and we'll give you a $35 rebate. That would have been perfect. The PUD could have, the public utility could have,
Yeah, and I imagine there would just have to be a lot of infrastructure put together in order to make that happen, and so that's why it ends up being something that costs. Tropical forests. This here has to do is basically just reforestation. All the places that have been cut down, burned down, slashed and burned, things like just the planting trees idea. I mean, we were talking earlier about the idea that if we planted a trillion trees, we would solve the climate change problem, and so. You know, that's just the potential if we can replant all the forest that has been lost in the tropics. We'll talk about this one here a little bit later on. The family planning one, I think I'll probably save that a little bit more until Wednesday when we talk about how many people can live on the earth. But I mean, you know, it's not too hard to imagine there that with better family planning, there will be less people on the planet, and with less people on the planet, there's a lower carbon footprint. And so, I mean, I guess the gist of it here is just by their estimates is that with proper access to birth control for women who want it and education and how to use it and educating girls in general, by the year 2050 there could be, they had it at 834 million people fewer on the planet than if we don't do this. And so you can imagine the carbon footprint of 834 million people and what a benefit it would be overall and how much easier it would be to deal with these problems if we had 834 million fewer people in the year 2050. Solar farms, that one is pretty self-explanatory. You've probably seen solar farms already around, and you know, this is just a matter of trying to find the places where it's amenable for doing it and scaling it up. Silvopasture, that is the concept of instead of cutting down all the trees to let your cattle graze, you sort of mix and match and you kind of have a mixed landscape of trees and grasses. And the benefits of having those two things together there, you end up sequestering a lot more carbon. I mean, and just in general, trees will sequester a lot more carbon than the grasses will. So by keeping those things together, by doing the mixed grazing within those sort of savanna-y type environments there, you can potentially sequester another 31 gigatons of CO2. And then rooftop solar, that one is also pretty self-explanatory. I mean, like in California, I don't understand why every building in California doesn't have solar panels on it. I mean, it seems ridiculous. And I mean, it seems ridiculous to the point that they shouldn't even be asking us to pay for it. They should just be doing it. Utility companies should just be putting solar on every rooftop in California. And you can do that, you know, you can do the calculations on how much energy you can produce there, but obviously this the same kind of idea here about what that would look like if you scale it up. So that's the top 10, but I wanted to just flip through a couple of these. Yeah.
I mean, you could break these down in a lot of different ways, but I'm looking at number 3, number 4, and number 9, and they all have to do with food production.
Yeah.
And if we add those together, it puts us up 7, 13, 168 gigatons.
Yeah.
All has to do with how we eat. And you could even look at tropical forests and a lot of tropical forests are going away, so we can have palm oil in our Oreos and cheap McDonald's burgers.
Yeah.
No one ever talks. We talk about petroleum. We talk about fossil fuels. Right. That is 2.5 times bigger than the biggest number up there.
Right. Right. And that, I mean, that's what I really like about this book so much here is that they put everything on the table. I mean, you know, we don't talk about educating girls in family planning as a way to solve climate change, do we? And yet, you do the math, and it's here, and it's something significant. And so I think that's what I appreciate here is that this is, you know, everything. Everything is there, you know. And including, depending on how much time we had here, I was thinking we could have an interesting and lively debate on whether we should have nuclear power or not in our arsenal for combating climate change, but I don't want to go there yet, so let's just see where we get. So I just wanted to go through, you know, some of the slides that Hannah has developed since she put the work into it. I think I need to show them to you. So this is educating girls number 6 with the estimate of 50 gigatons of CO2 that could be saved by working in, you know, currently 130 million girls are denied the right to attend school. And in South Asia, less than half attend secondary school. Sub-Saharan Africa, less than 1 in 3 are able to get to secondary schools. I mean, so that kind of gives you an idea about the scope of the problem. And of course, the ramifications of this are, you know, how this works. Women with more education have fewer children, healthier children are more likely to use birth control and manage the number of children that they have. And so the estimates here, I think I alluded to that already here, is that if nations were full on with the education of girls, there would be 843 million fewer people by the year 2050.
What about educating the men?
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
is it all women?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated thing here, and so the family planning and the educating girls, they lumped the two things together, and so when they did this calculation here, this 843 million, they actually came up with a number that was like 100 and something, and they just arbitrarily split it between the two because they're linked so closely together. I mean, educating men obviously is a big thing, is a you know.
It's another idea. Add it to the book.
Yeah. Melinda French Gates' new book is dealing with this, with educating women, and how what a difference it can make for everybody, not just the girls that get the education, but
her
book is really interesting. If you,
yeah, it's a ripple effect.
Uh huh.
You know, and so the cost of this is the idea. You know, the idea is that with $39 billion a year, we could get to universal education. And so then you think about the U.S. subsidy to the fossil fuel industries of $40 billion a year. That's a coincidental piece of math,
yeah,
isn't it? Where you know, if they just put that money in a different place, we could do amazing things with it. So, you know, another aspect of women is just that when you get natural disasters here, it kills more women than men for a variety of reasons. And so there's obviously there's a gender equity issue that goes along with all of this here too, but you know, when resources are slim, boys are given priority. There's
education but food.
Thinking about social susceptibility versus social resilience. And again, educating women increases that resilience, and so again, in these emergencies, when there are emergencies that happen, many more women die, but with more education, they're more resilient. It's less likely for I don't know what I'm trying to say. I think you kind of get the point here, but there's this idea here that for every additional year of schooling a girl receives, her country's resilience to climate disaster improves by 3.2 points.
Wow.
And I'm not quite sure what 3.2 points means, but it's just the idea here that education just increases that resilience here and sort of lessens the impact of these disasters. And so there's, you know, this goes beyond simply just the impact on climate. There's much more to it than just that. There's a whole social justice piece as well. And, you know, just the idea that if you, by tapping into all of the brain power that's untapped right now, you have that much more potential for coming up with solutions, other solutions, the 101st solution and the 102nd solution to this book here by fulfilling the full potential. You know, if I guess it's just it's a fundamental principle of just education in general. The smarter, the more educated everybody is, the more likely we are to be able to figure out solutions and get through some of these big issues. And so some of the solutions are pretty self-explanatory here. Obviously, just making school affordable. I mean, a lot of times it's easier just to have the girls doing work and getting water and supporting the household, because the family has to eat, the family needs food, the family needs income. And so if you can make school affordable, if you can make lower that economic barrier so that the girls are able to attend, that's an important part. Health barriers, I don't remember exactly what the example was for health barriers. Reducing time and distance to get to school, there's the concern there that the farther away a girl has to go, the more likely it is that there's going to be danger associated with it. They're vulnerable. And so, you know, simply getting bicycles that girls can use so that they can get to school would be another step in the right direction. But trying to reduce that time so that they can be safe when they go to school. Girl-friendly schools, you know, getting to secondary education. If you already have children, that's an issue. If you could provide some kind of a child care so that even young girls with children could still go, that would be an issue. Obviously, improving school quality is an important piece of it. Increasing the community engagement. This is sort of a changing the culture kind of thing. Right now, the culture is unfavorable in many environments for girls to go to school, and so you need the community. This can't just be, again, this is not about just putting it on the individual here. You need to have that support system around you in order to be able to make it go. And then sustaining girls' education during emergencies. Just because there's a crisis here doesn't mean that you stop educating and that's it. I mean, you have to have a way of being able to, I mean, sort of building that resilience into the education model as well, even in times of crisis and emergency. Yeah.
I was just at a chocolate tour last week in Seattle at Theo Chocolate, and they were talking about how their fair trade practices are in the Democratic Republic of Congo are reducing one of the thing barriers or bars they set is no kids working in the fields that we buy from. Because chocolate is a child labor friend, you know, it's massive kids are involved in it. So we can also support businesses that have fair trade practices that trickle down to this. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's just one other little way we can help, like being.
So you were talking about flight guilt earlier, now I'm having chocolate guilt.
just buy fair trade chocolate.
I know.
That fast fashion.
Yeah.
Fashion. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So another one there I figured I would spend a little bit of time talking about is the reduced food waste. And that was item number 3, and there were estimates there. It was basically about 2 years worth of fossil fuel emissions if we could cut down on by the year 2050, if we cut down on our waste. So currently 4.4 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent every year from the food that we waste. So about 8% of the total greenhouse gases are attributable just to food waste. And so this is an idea of how much land area it takes to produce the food that gets thrown out. So all of the US and Mexico and part of Canada just to produce food that doesn't ever get eaten. Yeah.
We have a feeding program in our church. Mm-hmm. We feed 100 to 150 people every Wednesday. All the food comes from grocery stores through a gleaner, they glean 7 days a week. It's amazing how much food's thrown away. Mm-hmm. And then we distribute it to food banks, so we don't use it. So, I mean, it can be a real effort to utilize food before it's totally outdated.
Right, no, I mean, it's you cannot eliminate it completely.
No.
There's no way that you can do that too, but you can certainly do a lot better. You know, and so then I think about, well, you know, just in terms of Poland, I mean, the educating girls, obviously we educate girls at Holden Village. I mean, they go to the school here, but, you know, so if you're going to take that on, then obviously you would, that would be in sort of an external program that you would need to take on to try to support folks who are working on that on educating girls worldwide. But, you know, what would be a proper response to food waste here at Holden? Obviously, we do pretty well already in terms of composting and things like that, but I see some massive mounds of food that are getting scraped off into the compost bin at every meal here. And, you know, and I think that it's, of course, you can have an impact, I think, on the folks that are here long-term staff and sort of try to change a culture. But when you've got guests that are coming in and out every week there, I mean, it's a little bit harder to change that thing. I mean, that's more of a nationwide culture than it is a Holden culture. But, you know, it would not be unreasonable for us to spend a little bit of time doing a little bit more education and trying to just chip away a little bit on taking what you can eat and no more. Yeah.
Paul Rohde this morning was talking about, he's at Augustana University, and he said that they no longer serve their food on trays in the cafeteria. They just...
To reduce, yeah.
They take a plate, and then they can't grab as much, and then there's not as much food wasted.
So Holden needs to come up with little plates like this, then, and we all said.
Or we all just need to eat more.
That's true. More I eat, so more eating.
I'm probably just confused, but in one of your earlier slides, you talked about three different areas of global temperature rise, CO2, was it NOx and methane?
Methane, yeah.
So we're focusing here on things we could do in the book there on CO2 reduction.
It's CO2 equivalent. So that's kind of a tricky, so you can convert. And so there's a little bit of CO2 equivalent, like the whole refrigerant thing, that's not CO2 correctly.
Okay, that's what I was trying to say.
That's a different greenhouse gas.
Will we get a bigger bang for our buck if we focused on some of the NOx stuff and the methane stuff, or are you saying that that's all built into the CO2 slide?
That's built into the calculation. So they take any of the greenhouse gases that are relevant here, and they've tried to convert that into a CO2 equivalent. Okay. That's basically what they've done, just to try to get it. Yeah, I mean, it's already complicated enough to try to understand what they do, but if you can at least put it all in a CO2 currency, that's a little bit easier to try to look at apples to apples and how it works. Yeah. Just some stats around food. I mean, you know, this puts things in context a little bit here too, but, you know, of more than a third of the food raised at the farm never makes it to a fork. There's nearly 800 million people worldwide who don't get enough food. You know, coincidentally, the amount of food that is used to, or the amount of grain that is fed to cattle would feed about 800 million people. Just, you know, another one of those little nice number things. You know, so about a third of food is wasted, one in seven people is hungry, and obviously if you could close the gap on that, we could solve two problems with one thing. So the idea on the calculation, so here is sort of the food waste, the greenhouse gas emissions. I think this was a chart that somebody else was asking for earlier here. So this kind of puts it in context of the greenhouse gas emissions. It says 6.2% for food waste, 25% electricity and heat, 20.4% agriculture and land, 17.9% industry, 14% transportation, 9.6% other energy, 6.4% buildings. And so that kind of gives you an idea that when you're trying to approach this problem here, you know, all these different areas that you have to sort of tap into to try to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. So the calculations here say that if you can cut food waste in half by 2050, we would avoid 26.2 gigatons of carbon dioxide emission. And then, of course, that avoids deforestation. And so that deforestation, which also would cost you 44.4 gigatons of CO2 emission, you would now save. So the cumulative effect of avoiding the food waste and then not having to clear land to produce that food combined would save you about 70 gigatons. Yeah.
So the food waste is that food that's wasted decomposing and producing greenhouse gas? Is that the CO2 equivalent
It's partly that, but it's also partly about the CO2 that goes into the production. I mean, the stat that I heard is that it takes about 10 calories of fossil fuel to produce 1 calorie of food that we eat.
Okay.
So yeah, so I mean that's just it's an energy intensive thing.
And
all those pieces. Yeah.
What's the source of that chart?
It's at climate.universityofcalifornia.edu. So this is just kind of another thing here. U.S., 40% of the food grown or raised in the U.S. is not eaten. Since 1974, there's been a 50% increase in food waste.
Wow.
Jeez.
Wow.
Cost about equivalent to, 25% of all fresh water, 300 million barrels of oil that are used to produce wasted food, $250 billion to the economy lost every year. Food waste is the single largest component sent to American landfills. And then, of course, you get all this decomposition in there and you start producing methane. And so all the methane that's produced there is a more potent greenhouse gas.
Can they use that as a fuel?
They do. Sometimes they try to capture that and use it as a fuel. Yeah, as a fuel. Yeah, so again, the scale of food waste is kind of daunting. So in the U.S., 50% of fruits and vegetables wasted, seafood wasted, grain products 38%, but you know we do prioritize our meat and dairy a little bit more, only about 20% wastage on that. And my guess is that bacon is somewhere around 5%.
It keeps a long time because of all the nitrates.
That's right. And then, I mean, this one is just phenomenal to me, too. You know, $165 billion in food thrown away, 20 pounds per person per month. I mean, that doesn't describe me, which means that there's somebody who's throwing away 40 pounds of food per month, and I just cannot fathom that, but it would fill 730 stadiums per year. Yeah, and then, of course, you know, there's obvious things here where, you know, requesting smaller portions or eating your leftovers or, I mean, composting is better than nothing. And obviously, you know, you talk about the food bank thing, which is donating food and trying to get food to the right places. In France, they passed laws there that forbid throwing food out without sending it off to charity somewhere. So, it's 3:30, so I'm going to quit here. We can fight about nuclear energy another time, maybe. But I'll leave it at that. If you've got questions, I'm happy to hang here for a bit.
At the church that I grew up in their kitchen, they still have the plates from 1960.
Uh-huh.
And you can hardly get any food on them compared to the plates we have nowadays. I mean, do you think that would even help on the food waste part of it?
Yeah, I'm for sure. I mean, it's so psychological, too. It's like I go to the whole line there, and I see stacks of bowls, and I know that one bowl is bigger than another one, and it's like I kind of flip through, and then I grab the bigger bowl. Or the plates. There's two different sizes of the plates there, and I look for the bigger plate. It's just so entrenched in there that it's really hard to shake that about getting that bigger bowl, bigger plate. I mean, you know, if I grabbed a smaller bowl, I don't know if it would have held two brownies.
It did.
It did? Okay. Yes.
Stack them.
But I did eat them. I ate it all. I didn't lick it, but I ate it all.
If you go back, then you get exercise.
Look at cups and mugs. You know, we used to use little coffee cups, and now it's got to happen.
Yeah.
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 Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.